touching the ground, I connect with all of life. Touching my heart, I awaken compassion for all life. You are listening to Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey, a podcast about life, the variety of lived spiritualities of the people around us, and how we are much more alike than different. I am your host, Brother Pax. I once heard of the spiritual life described as a spiral. It's a constant coming around to the same truths again and again. But each time we're changed by that fresh exposure to those truths. It's like the old analogy of water slowly wearing away the sharp edges of the rock that's poking out of the river. The Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 11, as Krishna saying, whatever a path a person travels to me is my path. In whatever way a person approaches me, and Krishna speaking of God, in whatever way a person approaches me, I return like for like. All paths lead to me, divinity. My years on this earth have led me to deeply dive into several spiritual traditions, each one coming to inform the others. Brother Wayne Teasdale coined the term interspirituality to describe deeply practicing more than one faith tradition. My guest today is Jory Pryor, who describes himself as an interspiritual contemplative, grounded in the Christian tradition, while also drawing from the esoteric traditions of Buddhism, Tantra, and Advaita Vedanta. Jory hosts a podcast called Methods of Contemplation, which showcases various techniques for prayer, meditation, and contemplation from across all spiritual paths. Joy serves also as a spiritual director for everyday people wanting to transmute their suffering to be a better service to the world. So enjoy this interview as we talk about interspirituality with Jory. All right, Jory, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So how about we start at the beginning? What kind of child were you and what cartoons did you watch as a kid?
Oh, man, that's a good one. I think what you watch as a kid can say a lot about your mindset. Yeah. Well, I grew up like in the early 90s, so that was kind of the golden era of kids television programming, so there was a million things that were forced into my brain.
Any favorites?
if I had to pick one, I'd say probably like maybe Courage the Cowardly Dog. That's
okay.
A standout.
I love Courage. I still love Courage. Yeah,
me too.
What kind of kid were you?
I was always kind of like a quieter, introspective kind of kid. I usually had more in common with adults than other kids my age. So I kind of kept to myself and I read a lot. I played a lot outside. I live kind of in the rural kind of country part of Maryland.
Okay.
So I was out in the woods a lot. Out in nature. That's pretty much it.
Were you raised religious?
Sort of. My dad's side of the family was kind of like country Methodist. Mm-hmm. And my mom's side of the family was, at least the immediate family, was non-religious. Although my grandmother on my mother's side and grandfather are both, or were both Episcopal priests. But my father's side was Country Methodist, and then eventually they left that and became like a non-denominational evangelical Christian. So did that for a while and got all kinds of screwed up from that, like most people do.
We're all in recovery for that, right? What started you kind of on your spiritual journey, or if not, what prompted you to start diving a little deeper?
Well, I'd kind of started diving deep when I was like pretty young. It's like around like 12 or 13. I started exploring like different forms of spirituality. And that was the time that my parents, my dad's side specifically, like were very exclusivistic, in terms of evangelicalism. So I kind of jumped around to see which things I could get away with. and so I ended up taking up martial arts basically to sneak in meditation.
So I
was reading like Takwan Soho or the Book of Five Rings and things like that, and trying to
light reading, huh?
Yeah. And trying to, steep myself in the Zen Buddhism tradition. And so around 13, I started meditating like pretty seriously every day. And so that depth dimension has always been kind of present, I think, for me. And then I forgot about it for a number of years and ended up coming back to it in the Christian tradition in my early 20s, mainly because I didn't know it was there before. You know, I thought that you had to leave the Christian tradition to get that kind of depth, because it was kind of off limits to my particular upbringing. But after coming back to it, I realized that, you know, the depth that I found in other traditions, Zen included, is present within the Christian tradition too.
Absolutely. You know, I remember back in my Baptist days, it was, you talk meditation, it meant that you were actually supposed to be memorizing a scripture and thinking on that scripture. And little did we know that there was a whole tradition, actually multiple traditions and streams within that. So when you were practicing the meditation and in martial arts, did you still consider yourself Christian, or were you kind of playing with the Buddhist or Taoist or something?
I had kind of dropped those labels at that point. And so I was experimenting with the expression of, you know, like, what would it be like to fully embrace this particular kind of spirituality? But I think, like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mirabai Star, but I've always been kind of like a spiritual debutante in that way, like just very fluid in my expression. Not to say that I'm not grounded in a particular way of practice, because I am, but I think the labeling is only important, I think, in relationship to other people. Like, if I'm talking to a Christian, you know, I'll identify as Christian as a way of, you know, connecting to someone else. But even though I may not specifically call myself Christian, you know, when I'm with someone like you.
Right. And so that term is used for interspirituality. Is that kind of what you would describe yourself as being?
Yeah.
Or what would you say?
I don't like that word either, really. Like, I mean, I've used it. It just, I don't know. No word's going to encapsulate, you know, the essence of what it means to be able to draw freely from all kinds of traditions. So I guess as a placeholder, interspiritual, I'll buy that.
Yeah, it's not my favorite label either. You know, I realize, oh, I think even preparing for this, I was like, I kind of fit that, but I don't like that. It makes it sound, I don't know. And so this kind of goes into this next question. So thinking of like 80s New Ageism, which picked and chose, you know, you might be doing a sweat lodge ritual that you picked up on the internet with something related to the chakras that may or may not be accurate, plus this. What distinguishes, say, a deeper interspirituality from that, from maybe a mishmash, would you say?
Yeah. I mean, I think particularly in the West, we have, and I've said this before, we have a penchant for extracting the shiny and colorful parts of other traditions, the stuff that's flashy and looks cool and it's easy to digest, and we kind of try to like bolt those on to kind of an amorphous kind of spiritual path. And I mean, nothing against anyone who right. takes that path, like whatever path you need to take for your particular incarnation is great. I just think it's very easy to do and easy to fall into what like Chögyam Trungpa calls spiritual materialism, where we try to own the path by taking these accoutrements of other traditions and trying to, appropriate them for our own purposes.
Right.
So I think the deeper way of being interspiritual, I think, is not necessarily staying on the fringes mm-hmm. of the, you know, the exoteric practices, but going deeper into where those traditions can speak to each other in terms that may be different, but are referring to a similar experience.
It was a monk at the Vedanta Center that had described it this way, and he maybe actually coming from Ramakrishna, but described it as digging a bunch of shallow wells and versus digging deep in. And maybe Thomas Keating, I may be just totally misrepresenting, but it was digging deep and finding the common stream underneath if you dig deep. And so, for example, in Christianity and Vedanta, you dig deep enough, you find they have a common well that they're drawing from,
yeah,
or something. Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You.
I was just going to say, I have heard that example so many times, and I think it works, but I also, I don't know, I push against it too, because when people usually say it, it's kind of against this aspect of interspirituality in terms of, they're saying a lot of times by using this metaphor, they're saying, well, you can't be in more than one path. You have to go right. all the way into one path. And I just don't think that's true. And I think the life of Ramakrishna is proof of that.
Right.
You know, he dug down to the bedrock in more traditions than one. And it was proof that you can hit water through multiple paths.
Right. Right. Yeah. He was initiated in several, even within Hinduism, and then as well as practicing and exploring Islam, Christianity. Absolutely. I think, you know, for me, I think it's just a matter of dig deep, whatever you practice, dig deep. And what traditions would you say are a big part of your practice currently?
So I primarily would consider myself influenced by Advaita Vedanta. That's probably the heaviest influence for me. Mm-hmm. But I'm also initiated into a Shakta Tantra tradition called Sri Vidya. I don't talk about that one as much because the tradition itself is more closed. It's a more, not secretive, but it's just a less open tradition than Advaita Vedanta. And but I also still draw from Christianity. I still draw from Buddhism, specifically Dzogchen, because Dzogchen Buddhism is so parallel to Advaita Vedanta.
Is there one that tends to be a little more foundational for you, from which kind of the others spring, or are they all equally influential?
Foundational? Definitely Vedanta. I say all the time that I didn't truly understand the person of Jesus or the person of Christ until I read the Bhagavad Gita, until I read the Upanishads. And so that is the framework, I think, that helps me. It's the interpretive lens, I think, that helps me to access the riches of other traditions, by using this hermeneutic that is available in the Hindu scriptures. It makes accessing that depth dimension in other paths more accessible, I think.
And again, so we both share a tantric lineage, not the same lineage, but we both tantric. So I know there's a lot you can't talk about, but for the listeners who may not know, what would be some of the cursory differences in tantra versus Vedanta? Because obviously in the West, some people hear the word tantra and they just think, oh, that's sex practices.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you can read like 10 academic texts on tantra and no one will give you the same definition,
right?
Because it's this kind of emergent category that the West seems to try and place as a framework on the diversity of Hindu religious practice. And but if I had to try and encapsulate it in a way that was just easy to communicate, I'd say that it's the using of, whereas Vedanta is more a process of distillation from the many to the one, Tantra basically, instead of negating the many to get to the one, Tantra effectively goes through the many to the one. And so in essence, it's kind of like a theological shortcut. But it also is usually associated with a progressive path, strangely enough. You know, whereas Vedanta is associated with direct realization, direct liberation, and Tantra is typically associated with lifelong practice. Strangely enough, I think Tantra is the shortcut, but then I also am viewing Tantra through the lens of Vedanta as well.
Right. It's hard to, separate those two, if they even should be separated. But yeah, it's interesting. You know, the way I kind of try to describe Tantra is everything is sacred. And by everything, it's everything. It's what you do in the toilet. It's what you do, you know, it's every experience, every, and even the unpleasant ones or the harmful ones. And so to try to realize divinity in all of that is also a challenge. It's a different way of approaching it versus, but maybe I'm also looking at it through the lens of Vedanta, because again, it's so hard, because that is our, I don't know about you, but my, you know, my primary exposure was through that as opposed to through Tantra. So maybe an unlearning. What role does Christianity play? What does it look like for you now?
for me, I use it as a bridge, because I'm situated culturally in the West, and for better or worse, Christianity is baked into the culture from the ground up. And so even if someone doesn't profess to be explicitly Christian, they likely have Christian themes woven into their subconscious and into their interpretation of the world, because that's how Western society has been inculcated for centuries and centuries. And so I think sometimes Christianity is a good bridge for people, because they are already steeped in those symbols and those traditions. And so I kind of use it as like a common language to talk with people. I don't have a specifically Christian practice. Like, I don't go to church or pray the rosary or anything like that. But similar to other traditions, I use them as like a shared language to just to dialogue with people.
Who is Jesus to you?
That's a good question. To me, Jesus was the embodiment of, I mean, really, really what the tradition says, Emmanuel, God with us. Jesus is what God looks like with clothes on. And as a parallel, I would equate that with what Advaita Vedanta calls Jivan Mukti, you know, liberated while living. And you can kind of split hairs on what you want to say of his divine nature, and that's sparked centuries of debate too. But you know, there's even in Advaita Vedanta, there's a difference between a Jivan Mukta and an avatara.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference between someone like you or I who takes up the path and hopefully becomes liberated in this life, versus the self-communication of God in human form. And so I think, as far as the Christian tradition goes, I think Jesus as an avatar, you know, is the most accurate thing to say. And I know that the tendency now is to humanize Jesus into this person that, you know, we can be like. And I think that's, for me, that's true. You know, that was the purpose of that avatar, of that incarnation, was to bring us into the possibility of being free while alive,
right,
as he was. So,
yeah. It makes me think of that Orthodox teaching of theosis, you know, it's divine becoming man, that man might become divine, or, you know, becoming God. Yeah. You know, I'm curious, I guess, what does your practice look like? What do you have, a daily practice? And if so, what does that look like?
I do my tantric practice daily. But as far as my core practice, that's, you know, that's a sitting practice. And that involves mantra and ritual worship and stuff. But if I had to point to a specific practice, I'd say in the Vedantic sense, what's called Nididhyasana, which sometimes gets translated as meditation, but it's essentially the resting with what you've found experientially. So there's a threefold division of practice in Vedanta called Shravana, hearing, Manana, reasoning out, and then Nidityasana, staying with. And so Nidityasana is probably the bulk of my practice, just staying with the confidence in the teachings, which can lead to, you know, things like deeper meditation or samadhi, or it cannot. It just depends.
Do you have a guru?
I do. I have a lovely Vedanta teacher named Jim. He's a 70, I think he's 74 now. Old hippie, from California, and he's the epitome of just humility and kindness, and but also steering intellect too. And then I have my tantric guru who, you know, initiated me in that tradition as well.
How would you describe God, Joy?
I wouldn't.
That should be easy, right? You got this.
I wouldn't. I mean, of course, and, you know, no words that we use to describe God can ever encapsulate the truth. But, and this is something that has been my delight the past few years, is that kind of around the Christian contemplative, Christian mystical circles, there's such an emphasis on this via negativa, this unknowing, this God of mystery, and a God that transcends categories and that you can never describe. And I was in that space for a while, but then I think there's this fixation for like post-evangelical Christians to get stuck there too, to get stuck in the idea that God is only unknowable, that God is only wrapped in this dark cloud of mystery. And I mean, if you look back at the exemplar of the tradition, Jesus, that wasn't the God that Jesus knew, right? Like, Jesus knew God intimately, as his own self even. And so for me, transcending the categories of knowing and unknowing is a more intimate divine knowing. So like the Christian contemplation, if you trace it back etymologically and you go back to contemplatio, to theoria, to gnosis, to da'ath, this Hebrew word for da'ath is this intimate sexual knowledge that comes when two embodied beings come together and make one flesh. And so that bridal mysticism of becoming one, for me, transcends the unknowing aspect of God. Because like Ramakrishna talks about, you know, once you've known, it's like a person who's mute trying to tell you about the taste of candy, or tell you about the taste of something sweet, and they can't describe it to you. And I think that's true, but I also think that it's a natural outflowing of God to try to do that, and that it's okay. You know, like everyone always shares this quote that silence is God's first language and all else is poor translation. And that's beautiful, and I absolutely agree with that 100%. But God is bilingual, and God's second language is poetry. Because even though you're never going to get it right, it's still part of the expression of divinity to explore our divine nature and try to put words to something that we know is ineffable. And so for me, God is both static and dynamic, and both and neither.
That's good. Wow. I don't know that I would have been able to, I would have stumbled on it. Not sure I would have gotten any type of description and non-description at the same time, but you did a great job. That's a tough question. Joy, you also provide spiritual direction. And for people who don't know what that is, what happens if someone were to come to you for spiritual direction? What is that?
Yeah, I started doing that maybe a year and a half ago. And I myself was a benefit of spiritual direction for a number of years. And it was in the typical style that is prevalent now, which is heavily focused on divine listening, and providing space for someone to express and to bring things up from their subconscious and to express them and then have them mirrored back lovingly by someone who values their highest good. And my experience in spiritual direction was wonderful for that. But then there was a period in my path where I realized that I had gotten what I needed to from that. And from there, I sought out more direct pointing instruction, like in the realms of Advaita Vedanta and Dzogchen. And I think I may have not been ready for that if it weren't for the previous spiritual direction. But I do think that that offers a necessary and helpful way to balance. Once you've torn apart the furniture in the living room of your soul, so to speak, and you're trying to figure out what now, rather than resting in this like kind of complacent, unknowing, amorphous whatever. If people can do that, more power to you. But for me, I was just like, I need something more. There has to be something more than just shrug. I don't know, you know? And so the direct pointing instructions are really what brought me the most growth and transformation and joy. And so I try to incorporate both of those things into spiritual direction. You know, I try to create space and practice sacred listening for the other person to provide that initial aspect that I benefited from. But then I also try to pass on the teaching that was given to me via direct instruction, and just pointing out the nature of mind and pointing out the nature of inherent perfect awareness that's present within us, and just hammering that over and over again and drilling it into our psyche. For me, that was the way to remove the obscurations, because I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I think I was a little thick in that I needed to hear the same thing over and over and over again until it finally stuck. And so yeah, I try to combine sacred listening and direct instruction in one format for spiritual direction.
You know, and what advice would you give someone? Maybe they're starting to look at multiple paths and they're feeling conflicted. As you know, sometimes in some religions, they shun looking at multiple paths, or even in modern society, oh, you can't do that. You're just shallow. You're not going to. What advice would you give them?
I'd say that you really don't know what's going to push your buttons until you let it. And so if you're drawn specifically toward one tradition, then try it out. And, you know, don't just, you know, dip a toe in, like actually fully do it, you know, mm-hmm. and give it the chance. And you should know if you're already in this space, if you're already a spiritual seeker, you already have this awakened intuition. You know, you already know what spirit feels like. And that's why you're here. And so you should trust your own intuition, in that if you jump both feet into a tradition and something just isn't hitting, you should trust that and then back off and try something different. But the caveat to that is the whole enterprise of spirituality is about taking our normal way of looking at things and cleaning that off, cleaning that lens. And you can call that lens ego, you can call it avidya, you can call it whatever you want to call it. But it's very tricky in that a lot of times I've seen, you know, people try one particular tradition or one path or one type of meditation, and they'll try it for, you know, 30 days, 60 days, sometimes 6 months or longer, and then say, nah, this isn't working. And then they move somewhere else. But I think the nature of the diversity of paths to the divine is such that any one of them can take us all the way. Any one of them can take us completely home. And so if we move about too much without going deep, then we allow the ego to kind of take the reins of our spiritual practice. And right when we're kind of on the threshold of going to a deeper level and finding some sort of breakthrough or realization, it senses that and then pulls us towards something else. So yeah, there's a gift and a danger, I think, in trying out different traditions. You know, it can help expand your way of thinking, so that, like, if you're coming from the Christian tradition and you're curious about Hinduism, then it can, like it was for me, be the key to unlock Christianity and to feel more at home in the tradition. But then it can also be a way of just kicking the can down the road too.
Right. So imagine you were stranded on a deserted island with only 3 books. What books would you want with you?
Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay.
Number one. For leisure. And then there's a text called Tripura Rahasyam, mm-hmm. which is probably my favorite scripture. And then there's another scripture called the Avadhuta Gita. It's also one of my favorites.
Right.
But I think those 3 would be my top.
Right. Joy, if someone wanted to learn more about you and what you do, how would they go about finding you?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on Instagram. My handle is at Methods of Contemplation. And there's a link in the link tree on my bio if you want to schedule spiritual direction. I also have links to guided meditations on there for free. I have a 5-day free course on Christian mysticism that's available, and a ton of other stuff. So yeah, that's the best way to contact me, right, at Methods of Contemplation.
All right. Well, Joy, thank you so much for being on here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Yeah, this was fun.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. This has been another episode of Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey. Thank you for walking with me as we spent time exploring the varieties of religious and spiritual expressions out there. Won't you consider joining our Patreon? Get sneak peeks of what is to come, early previews, and soon to have some video footage from the interviews, as well as polls on what you would like to see covered in future episodes. Join our Patreon today. The link is in the show notes.